Hey folks, welcome to the Hang Your Own Hang podcast, a monthly podcast about hammocks, hammock camping, and everything related. Our goal is always is to enlighten you if you're a ground dweller, and to entertain you if you're already a tree dweller. I'm Jonathan Kupel, and this is my co-host, Mark Baldwin.
Evening, Jonathan.
How's it going, man?
Good, good. We are getting into the end of the school year for the kids and the beginning of actual summer, so that means in New York, it's construction season, which means detours, detours, detours.
There are days when I'm really grateful that I telecommute.
Yeah, it's tough. I was out at the stadium last night, and it just took forever there between traffic and the Skyway being shut down. And it's just, you know, we have, like we always say, we have two seasons in Buffalo, winter and construction.
Oh, well. Well, I have some news for our listeners, if they're willing to hear it, which is that we are considering retiring the podcast.
Yep.
Talking about that for a long time. There's still plenty to talk to, but you know, we have other interests that we want to pursue.
Yeah, yeah. It does take time, especially your time, since you do a brunt of the work. And with kids in college and high school and sports, it gets tough sometimes.
But I know that we've got a lot of folks who are listening right now. And I am thinking that we are definitely open to the possibility that there could be two new hosts that might be interested in taking over the podcast. So if you've been listening to the podcast for a long time and you are as crazy about podcasting and hammock camping as we are, I know there's a bunch of you out there. I know Mark and I would love to get you guys up to speed and hand over the reins to a new generation of hammock camping podcasters. Today's episode is going to be Tim Watson. He is a YouTuber. I will include some links to the show, but we're really lucky to have Tim on. I think he's kind of a dad, you know, part-time camper guy. He loves to document the experiences he has, and I think we'll have a lot of fun talking to him.
Yeah, he does a great job. I've been watching him for a while now, and he does a really good job on his videos.
He's very authentic. It's a pleasure to watch him.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and big-time hammock camper too, which is always a plus.
Yep. So let's get on with the interview. All right. So I'd like to welcome to our episode, our podcast episode this month, Tim Watson of Tim. I don't even know if your channel has a channel other than the awesome Tim Watson channel.
No. Yeah. The channel name is my name. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. We're really glad you came on board. I know I've been a big fan of watching a lot of your YouTube videos for some time. Mark, I think you are familiar with it too.
Oh, yep.
I thought it might be fun. It's, you know, a really down-to-earth conversation with another family guy who likes to grab chances to go camping and hiking every once in a while. First, I'd like to say, I saw in one of your videos, before we get into the backpacking thing, that you had a buffalo shirt.
Yeah.
And Mark and I, as our listeners probably know by now, are both in the Buffalo area. Are you in Buffalo or near Buffalo, or what's the connection?
I am not in Buffalo right now. I'm in Ohio, but I have a strong connection to Western New York. And I actually lived in West Seneca for a year, but I went to college and grad school in the Western New York area. So went to college at Houghton College for a couple of years and then grad school at Alfred University. So I'm really familiar with the area. Super big Bills fan. So go Bills, go Buffalo.
That's funny. Go Highlanders, right?
I know Mark is probably going to chime in here. What's that?
Go Highlanders.
Yeah, Highlanders, yes.
Isn't that
he's talking about Houghton. Yep, you got
the
it.
The Houghton mascot. Go Highlanders.
Yeah, and so actually, it's so funny you mentioned that. That was, I think that was one of the new pushes during the year that I was there. They were kind of doing their marketing thing, trying to get together what they're gonna be and their mascot. But yeah, they're definitely the Highlanders now. I see it all the informational stuff they send out there.
the informational stuff, like give us money.
Information, right? Yeah, so support students, you know, like me, and I benefit from a ton of scholarships, academic and otherwise. So
yeah, well, that's great. So so I know, you know, having your experience in Western New York and in the area, you don't have a problem finding trees for hammock camping, but you must have gotten into camping earlier than that. Hammock camping is relatively recent. When did you get into, I guess, camping in general? And then, you know, how did you move from there to getting into your first hammock?
Oh, this is going to super shock you then. I probably did not get into camping until about 3 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I'd say my experience was not, I did not come from a camping family at all. It was not something I did. It actually started about a couple years ago. I went hiking for, honestly, I had done some hiking in the Adirondacks mm-hmm. because my roommate was from that area. And I liked it, but it wasn't something that really stuck with me. But I went hiking in Hocking Hills here in Ohio. And I remember having the experience of thinking to myself, why didn't anyone tell me that all this great stuff is out here? So I remember having that experience and being like, I want to see more of this stuff. And so that's really when I started to get more into camping and backpacking as well.
Awesome. And you went from your original camping experience was probably in a tent. That's something that we mostly share. What got you from a tent into a hammock?
Well, I enjoy sleeping. And so it was either I went to, I've slept in tents before prior to that point, and I knew I did not like it. I just could not fall asleep on the ground. It was not something I enjoyed. And so I think, my friend Josh Ebersole, who shows up on the channel, actually from the very beginning, Subaru Josh.
Yeah. Your buddy who got married.
Yeah.
Exactly. That was cool.
Yeah, he was into the backpacking world and he mentioned hammock camping. And I thought, okay, I could give that a try. I remember hammocks from when I was a kid and I thought, I'll give that a shot. And so that's how I jumped right into it, which is not something I usually recommend. But I went ahead and said, hey, if I'm going to do this thing, I'm going to do it right. I'm going to start with what I know is one of the Ferraris out there in the hammock camping world. And I started with a Warbonnet Blackbird XLC.
Okay. Yep. Yep. A great choice.
That was my first one. Because I thought to myself, hey, if it's going to work and doesn't work with one of the best ones out there, it's not going to work for me. So I started with that and I slept great. I think I sleep better in my hammock. Actually, I know I do. Using my Fitbit to monitor sleep, I sleep better in my hammock than I do in my bed.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm sure that you're not bragging about that at home.
No, I don't talk about it too much.
So what do you do for your real life? I presume that you have a career that's not in the outdoors, especially since you've only been camping for a few years.
Yep, you'd be right. I'm actually a psychologist for a local school district. I've done that for, oh my gosh, this is my 10th year now. Mm. And so that's what I do in real life. I work with a lot of special education and evaluations and some counseling and consulting of teachers. And so I do that for a local district.
Awesome. Awesome. And what else do you do for fun besides camping?
Well, yeah, backpacking, camping. I do recently a lot of cycling.
Okay.
I've gotten into doing that specifically a little bit of road just around the neighborhood casually. Neighborhood and larger loops around my city, but as well as some gravel riding, bike packing. It's kind of fun. I've done that a few times now. And then I also have gotten into a lot of target shooting. I haven't done it recently just because backpacking and stuff has taken that up, but I used to do that pretty heavily and instructing for, I'd say 3 or 4 years. But just now camping has kind of taken over that time slot that I used to have for that.
Yeah.
Getting into all the expensive hobbies, huh?
Yeah. Yep. That was one that for a while there it was.
That's funny. Yeah. I don't want to get into it too deeply, but I'm curious to know what your position is on e-bikes on on mountain biking trails, the electric assist. I know here in the States, there's some controversy. I know in Europe, they've, you know, widely accepted it because it's really opened up the industry to a lot of newcomers. But some people are like, I don't like the idea of having the electric assist bike. It's going to kill the trails or whatever.
Yeah. And, you know, I was actually talking with, while we were on our last trip, talking to, with my buddy Kyle about that. And I don't have, I don't have a huge issue with it as long as it's not, as long as it's an assist, you know, where it's not something that's constantly on where you could stop pedaling and it moves for you as long as
it's a motorcycle.
Exactly. But there are some e-bikes I think out there who, you know, where it will propel you. It's not just an assist, I believe.
Yeah.
And so we were talking about that and I said, as long as it's an assist, I mean, to help with the uphills and if you enjoy just the downhill mountain biking stuff, I get it. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. I know it makes it a lot more accessible.
Yeah.
Especially for the mountain biking thing.
Yeah.
Now, do you go camping with your family? Is it just you solo or with friends?
I'd say I mostly go solo with friends, but this year especially is when I'm starting a big push for, I have three kids, and so now all three of them are at the age where I feel comfortable. I can kind of trust them to go out camping with them beyond just, I mean, we've done, of course, backyard camping and some campground stuff that's just primitive campgrounds. But now I feel this is the year where I'm starting to say, okay, I have to spend some more time going car camping and camping as a family. We've gone hiking quite a bit as a family, but an overnight camping trip is something we haven't done very often outside of the backyard as yet.
Oh, now, how old are the kids?
So we're talking, we just had birthdays. So 9, 7, and 5.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Just my kids. And it's in terms of oldest to youngest, it's girl, girl, boy.
Oh, okay.
5-year-old, I feel like just reached the age now where like he'll mostly listen
to everybody but you.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, they're getting to that age. I think we started, I mean, my daughter, I think, was 2 years. So she was actually a little bit older, around 11. But yeah, I think it all depends on, you know, their size and just making it fun for them by, you know, small day packs. And it definitely is going to make you not ultralight.
Yep. I've already started thinking about, I've already started thinking about what my overall loadout as a dad will be, how it'll be different, extra stuff I have to carry. And of course, because you don't want them to carry too much weight and miles, cutting down miles.
Yep.
And so it should be interesting move to see exactly how that changes things. But one thing I'll say is they've been excited to go from the time I've started going backpacking, because they see some of the videos and they see a lot of the pictures, and every time I leave, it's one of those things where, Dad, can we go with you this time to the Smokies? Or, Dad, can we come with you? And I said, not on this trip, and I keep putting it off. But this is the year. We'll do at least one big one this year. I'm not sure where we'll go, either the Smokies or Red River Gorge, and give them just a good, maybe a base camping idea or something where we can do some out and backs.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's great. And then how about your wife?
She is not into it.
Roughing it is a Super 8 instead of a holiday. Or
yep, you got the exact idea. I know we've talked about before. I think what will my key, I believe, will be getting the kids into it, because she doesn't like to be left out of that family stuff. Mm-hmm. And so if the kids are really into it, and you know, I'm going with them, she doesn't want to be left behind and have the kids come back and say, hey, we did this or we did that, and we wish you were there, Mom. That's where I think the first time she probably will treat it like a vacation. But after that, I think she'll want to come.
Yeah, well, once the kids get old enough and they can carry all their own stuff, then you'll have to carry her stuff. And the kids the kids can just guilt her into it.
Yep. And she does not love the idea of no bathroom.
Yeah, that's a big thing with my wife too.
And I always tell her, hey, I would rather do my stuff out in the woods. It's cleaner to me than a public restroom.
From a hygiene perspective, you make a really good point.
Exactly, yeah. Right?
Yep. Especially if you think of some of these privies where you know, you've got a few foot drop from when you do your business. And as opposed to a restroom that's who knows who was in it before you and the last time it was cleaned.
Exactly. And, you know, I think people who watch my channel will be amused at how quickly we turn this conversation to pooping in the woods.
Well, we've interviewed Shug before, so.
It's all about the edit.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I did see that you hiked out in the Finger Lakes Trail. Mark and I have actually been on the same trail, Letchworth. Very nice.
Yes. Yes. The Letchworth Trail was a lot of fun, except the year that we did it was when we had that really bad drought, if you remember that. But I guess it was about 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Letchworth just from, you know, just being in that area in my old stomping grounds. That was the place to be, is Letchworth State Park, and hit up all the falls from, you know, when you're over the college, it's only about 35 minutes away. And I just thought, you know what? I want to go back there and do that. The Letchworth Trail, when I saw it, was a thing. And it was interesting because of how dry it was. So the falls were a lot less than they usually were. And the trail was so dry. You could tell where there were, you know, lots of creeks were supposed to be. I remember spending, it was about 30 minutes at this one spot trying to get water using leaves as funnels.
Oh my god!
To get into our dirty water bag and just trying to get what water we could.
Yeah, there's no springs. That's all drainage.
Yes, yes. And so I think someone later said what it is that they said that they actually were, yeah, lots of drains and creek beds, you know, but they weren't creek. There were actual creeks, but mm-hmm. a lot of the drainage ditches, I guess, that run through that area were full when he went through. And so he just noted it was a huge difference between my video and what his experience was, which was good for him.
Yeah, they've actually they've replaced the train bridge since you've been there.
Yes, they were working on it.
Okay. Yeah, they just finished it up a little while ago. Very cool. If you're not hiking out this way, which is probably a lot more rare, where do you like doing your camping and hiking, even car camping? Where's good to go on your area of the country?
My big areas that I hit up a lot are, I go to Red River Gorge a fair amount because that's about 3.5 hours from me. Mm-hmm. And I also like going to the Smokies whenever I can. The Smokies I've been to, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 times at this point. Just on backpacking trips. And usually that's one of the big things that I know my fellow Ohio campers, YouTubers, backpackers make fun of me sometimes, because believe it or not, I have been hiking in Ohio and I've camped in Ohio, but I've actually never done a backpacking trip in Ohio. I always kind of scoot, because I figure I got the day off, I'll scoot over to Kentucky, or I'll scoot down to Tennessee. I'll take the drive and might as well do something kind of big and epic if I can. And so those are the areas I try to hit up whenever possible. The gorge, I like how accessible it is. I can kind of get there in, you know, pretty much half a day and make it that area.
Really enjoy your views about ultralight and about hammock camping. Seems like your feelings about camping and gear is much more pragmatic.
Yeah, I try to make it that way on purpose. I guess, especially when I present it on the channel and in real life as well, is, hey, ultralight is great. I enjoy it. I mean, if you look at my loadouts, they're pretty much ultralight loadouts or just over that line, you know, 10, 11 pounds. If you look at 10 pounds is the marker. But I try to be pragmatic, not only in real life, but in camping as well. It's like whatever works for you, works for you. As long as you've tested and tried it and you're happy with it, that's great. I usually try to present what I do, and so you could try that too. And that's kind of just my overall perspective. I try to maintain being a little grounded and not just going one way or another, because it's kind of easy to go to the extremes, I think.
Now, do you think using your hammock is a lighter weight alternative as opposed to a tent, or is it just something that you like?
For me, it comes down to sleep and rest, but no, it's not a lighter alternative for me. I think you can always go lighter with a tent if you really, you know, we're trying to shave weight. I think people have asked me that before, and I usually say, nope, if you really want to go light with a tent, you can. I mean, look at the things like the Z-Pax duplex, or the, I think it makes sense in terms of the ground area that people can, the space that they can have in the tent. I don't think a hammock setup will truly ever, I'm sure you could try, but standard hammock setup is not going to beat a tent setup in terms of weight, I think.
Definitely. But you know, you get that sleep and you don't have that rock or that root that's in your shoulder blade that always happens. So.
Exactly. Yeah. So for me, hammock camping is definitely a comfort thing.
Right. Now, okay. There's been a couple of videos I know that's annoy our listeners. Why are you still using the sleeping pad?
A sleeping pad in my hammock, believe it or not. And it's funny, I started off with a sleeping pad in my hammock. Mm-hmm. And
so did
I. To me, the natural progression was, you know, if you see on YouTube or you read the forums, the natural progression should be, everyone says you get an underquilt. And so I did the underquilt thing for a while. I had the Enlighten Equipment Revolt, I believe, right? Is it the Revolt? Yes.
Yeah.
The Revolt underquilt. And I enjoyed it. I mean, it was fine. It was warm. It was definitely more comfortable. And I will always tell anyone who asks me about the pad and the hammock is that the underquilt is more comfortable by far. Mm-hmm. The big reason I use a sleeping pad in my hammock is because the fear of going to the ground. And so I was kind of waffling on using a sleeping pad, but I did a Western trip out to Four Pass Loop in the Maroon Bells in Colorado. And I didn't know for sure if I could use my hammock all the time, because you know how it is out west. The availability of trees is not necessarily the best. Sometimes you can have camps that are definitely made only for tents. So I wanted the flexibility of going to the ground. And then it just kind of became a thing. It kind of became a thing where I'm like, well, I'm fine on my pad. I sleep just as well. I have to pay more attention to my hang angles using the pad in terms of comfort, so I don't get any kind of knee pain for me. And so, you know, keeping the foot end a little higher works well, and staying on the pad. But that's the big reason, is that I'm still out east. I honestly don't worry about it as much. I generally can find a hammock camping spot. But in the Smokies, so to give you another example, in the Smokies, you're required, if you're on the Appalachian Trail, to stay in the shelters if you're on the Appalachian Trail. And so I remember another thing that kind of emphasized it for me is we did a loop where we stayed at the campsite one night. So I had my hammock set up, and then we stayed in the shelter the second night. And so I wanted to have that flexibility of being comfortable in the shelter. And that's really the reason why I started with the sleeping pad and transitioned back to the sleeping pad, and now I'm back again.
Now, do you, family excluded, do you prefer camping with friends and such, or do you prefer camping and hiking alone?
I actually prefer camping with friends. To me, it's more enjoyable. I've done the solo things a couple times at this point, and it's just not – I think I enjoy it for the reflection time, but for me, camping and hiking and seeing some awesome things are about the experience and sharing with other people. And so I end up, a lot of times on my solo trips, I'll do one of those double takes where I'm like, hey, did you see? And then I'm like, oh, there's no one here but me.
<That's> funny.
So I really enjoy sharing the experience with friends and family. And I definitely see the appeal of solo backpacking and solo camping. But in general, I'd rather go with someone else. But I make sure that that isn't an excuse not to go. So if absolutely no one else can come, I'm going by myself. But I would rather someone come with me.
A lot of your content on your gear is about cheap options, which I love, for packing and camping. Now, is this something you think about a lot? Do you plan on trying to go that route?
No, I one reason I present on my channel is I found, especially when you're producing content, it's pretty easy to forget about that stuff, honestly. it's easy to say, well, this is what I use, and be it mid-tier or upper-tier stuff. And you kind of forget that, hey, not everyone wants to spend a couple $100 on a 20-degree quilt. Right. Or not everyone wants the top-of-the-line hammock. Some people are fine with, you know, the Eno line of hammocks, which can work really well for a bunch of people. I didn't want to lose sight of making sure that I had different budgets in mind when I present gear. Mm-hmm. So that's where the cheap options came up with. And honestly, a lot of the ideas that you see on the channel actually come from viewers and people commenting and saying, hey, you should do X, Y, and Z. And I think to myself and I say, that's actually a really good idea. And so I go ahead and plan a video on that topic.
Oh, okay. Now, do you think going cheap is a better way, knowing that like, you know, you're gonna have to buy it again, and why should I invest a lot now where I'm gonna have to purchase it again in, you know, 12 months or something like that?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a great question. I'd have two different approaches that I like to talk about. The one is my personal approach. My personal approach is, honestly, I'm gonna try the best I can, because I like the idea, I think I've mentioned this in the video before, I like the idea of, if it doesn't work for me, I'm going to resell it and not lose a whole lot of value on it. But also, I recognize if someone isn't sure if they're going to commit to the hobby or camping seriously, then you should probably start with a cheaper option just to see if it's even something you want to stick with. So I think there are definitely two competing ideas or approaches, and both are fine. I think I usually end up going back to whatever you think you can commit budget-wise to a camping item or a backpacking item that you're comfortable with. Go ahead and commit X dollars and work with what you have. And then if you realize, you know what, this thing is not working for me, I want to try something a little more expensive or something a little bit more custom, then go ahead and do that. And so it goes back to, I know we were talking about being a little more pragmatic, but it's figuring out what works best for you, and that's a lot different than what works for me.
Yeah, I like the idea of using cheaper gear to see if it's something that you like. Like a couple of years ago, exactly, I was thinking about getting trekking poles. And, you know, some of the good brands and all, they're going to, you know, you're going to pay upwards up to $100 plus,
yep,
on them. And I didn't want to make the investment. So actually, I got a cheap pair from Walmart. They're like $17.
Yeah.
And I loved them. And actually, surprisingly, you know what? I still have them, and I'm still using them. And I've been wanting to think about getting a better pair. Sure, they might be a few ounces lighter or whatnot, but you know what? These ones still work great.
Yeah, and that doesn't shock me at all. I think my buddy Subaru Josh still uses his pair that he got from, I think, Dunham's Sporting Goods store a while ago. And, I mean, when you boil it all down to the core, it's pretty much just metal sticks.
Hey. Yeah. Yep.
Or carbon fiber sticks, I guess.
Yeah.
I feel much better now.
Now, is there any gear that you recommend that you do not go cheap on and purchase, make the investment on?
Yes. Anything that's water purification or anything that is directly related to survival and health, I recommend not going cheap on those things. So I mentioned the water filters. I know there's some purely Chinese made knockoffs of things, and it doesn't mean it's necessarily poor quality, but it's something where I would rather trust US based manufacturing processes, I guess, than someplace that's a little bit more overseas. Or in the case of things like shoes, I think it was whatever is directly related to the experience, I tried to not go cheap on that. Shoes is another big one. Just as long as you're comfortable and you know it works for you. But personally, I try not to go cheap on shoes.
Yeah, I could definitely see the shoes. I mean, sore feet could definitely make or break a trip.
Yeah. But you know, it goes back to, if you have a pair that you know works well for you and you're not getting any blisters or it's still going to protect your feet, then I mean, that's great.
Right.
We always get parents asking us in the scouts what shoes they should be buying for their scouts. And I always stand by my first statement, which is let them wear what they're wearing all week. It'll dry out.
Yeah.
You know, those, yeah. those sneakers they wear 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours a day. They're not going to blister up in sneakers.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things you have recently got into, and it's on your videos, and we were chatting about it before we started recording, is you've started a little bit of bike packing, and I'm very interested in this. This is something that I'd like to do as I get older with my wife. We have a tandem mountain bike.
Oh.
And I thought bike packing would be a really great way to do to get out in the woods with her. How did you get into bike packing?
So I actually started maybe a year or two ago. My buddy Kyle kept bugging me, and he kept saying, "Dude, you should really get into gravel riding or bike packing. That'd be a really great thing." And he said it seems like it's taken off in some segments, and I kind of hemmed and hawed for a while, but then I thought, okay, well, I'll go ahead and give it a try. And sure enough, it was fun. It's like, it's just like backpacking, but with a bike. And so it's one of those things where my friends, fortunately, just keep kind of nudging me in different directions, and it seems to work well. They seem to know what I would like or enjoy sometimes before I know it.
That's very cool. Now, in terms of when you're planning, are you doing more off-road or are you doing more on-road distance?
So what we've been doing so far is we've been doing a lot of gravel. And so if you think about, there are a lot more segments to cycling than I know about, honestly, but the three main ones I think of are road, gravel, and mountain. And gravel is kind of firmly in that middle squishy area where we have wider tires. We tend to have disc brakes on our bicycles.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tend to go in that in between areas where road bikes usually can't go, and mountain bikes would maybe be a little bit of overkill. And so we try to do those whenever we can. So I think my friends did a rail trail last time, but we were also down in Southern Ohio on some definitely all loose gravel roads. That was a lot of fun to do. And so we don't do a whole lot of on roads. So that's more, I guess you'd call that more touring.
Yep.
Bikes. I guess you could still camp and do primitive camping and bike packing, but we haven't done a whole lot of on road stuff. It's kind of a mix. So if I had to think about it, it would be about 70% gravel, then maybe 30% road.
Okay. Now, when you're thinking about distance, do you like the fact that you can cover more distance bike packing? Is that one of the benefits, do you think, or how much distance do you do in a day?
To me, that's not as big of a plus. It does end up happening just because you're moving faster on your bike. I think so far it's varied. We're talking about upwards of, it depends on, of course, the elevation, but 15 to 20 miles in a day fairly easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tend to do, it seems like at least, a bunch more elevation, a bunch more up and down on the bike so far on the trips that we've done. But yeah, one of the big benefits, of course, to going uphill is that you get to go downhill. So that part's much more fun.
Do you have to compete a lot with cars on the trails you're doing? It sounds like you're not doing a lot of like regular road touring, but I know cars, especially in New York, they don't like bikers very much.
Yeah, I think that's pretty universal. So I think around here, especially if we stick to more roads, the cars definitely are not big fans of us being on there. But so far, I mean, it's been, even though I've heard that before and I've seen it occasionally, most cars are pretty good when we've stuck to the road.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we're not, you know, goofing off in the middle of the road or anything, we're kind of following the traffic laws and being respectful just in general, you know, waving them on if we see the ways clear ahead that they can pass. So everyone so far has been pretty good. But yeah, you're right. A lot of the gravel stuff is we run into an occasional truck or vehicle, but typically not very many cars out where we have been so far.
Oh, that's cool. For my wife and I, because we're doing more touring or gravel paths as well, because you can get farther distances, usually we can make it to a hotel or a bed and breakfast in the same day. So we're actually thinking about maybe biking from state park to state park where, you know, we've at least got a bathroom the next morning when we get a little bit older. We thought that would be a lot of fun.
That would be a lot of fun. I think if you follow on YouTube, a great bike packer gravel more casual rider is path less pedaled. Mm-hmm. And he and his significant other do a bunch of that, and they do a ton of rail trails. Now, the rail trails are fun because someone that told me this is because they're designed for the trains. They don't go over a 1% grade.
Right.
And so it's never super steep. And so, yeah, you know, you have a slight uphill or slight downhill, but it's never super, like a really bad elevation change. So that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we did a big chunk of the Erie Canal together, and we had a similar experience for the same reason. The water grade changes, except where you hit the locks, the water has to be almost flat.
Yeah, yep.
But I'll have to check that out. That sounds really cool. I'll add a link to that to our listeners as well in the show notes, that they can check that site out. That looks really neat.
Now, getting into one of my favorite parts, food. Describe your ramen bomb.
That ramen bomb video also always makes me laugh, because I think that's, to me, that's one of the quintessential backpacking foods, because it's easy, it's fast, and it's like one of the most like filling foods I think I've ever made on the trail, where it just sticks to your ribs and, yeah, man, you go to bed happy. So all it is you can make this a variety of ways, of course, but mine is I use a freezer bag, and in advance I've prepared, there's some I've opened the ramen packet usually and crunch up the ramen a little bit, put the seasoning in there, add some dehydrated potato mix, and that was what was in my pack. And so I add boiling water to that, mix it all up, let it sit for a little bit. I also chop up some Spam and toss that in there and mix it all together, and there we go. That's the ramen bomb. And so, yeah, that's one of the things
that sounds so good.
It's one of those things where I think people, when they see me make it, they're like, "You're gonna eat that?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm gonna eat all of it." And usually some people don't believe my can, but usually after a hard day hiking or backpacking around, I usually my dinner is definitely my biggest meal. I want to go to bed full. It helps keep me warm, and I stay asleep longer.
Now, how important is food when you're camping or hiking?
To me, it's more, I know you said it was kind of your favorite thing about the backpack camping experience. To me, it's more fuel. And so it's a matter of, I know some people will do some more elaborate cooking. So, you know, steak or kind of hobo type meals. Mm-hmm. For me, I've always stuck to a lot of bars, a lot of things I can make and eat on the go if I can. I have not gone as far. I'm not even going to try it. The cold soaking.
Yeah, that doesn't appeal to me either.
No. It does not appeal to me, but I do a lot of dehydrated food, especially Mountain House meals. And I should mention that I'm a Mountain House ambassador. And so just make sure everyone knows that. But I do use a lot of Mountain House.
Huh. Now, outside of your ramen bomb and your Mountain House, or even including that, what do you like to make when you're eating dinner, or since, you know, that's your big meal, or go through a quick day, you know, your breakfast, lunch, and dinner? What would you be packing?
So breakfast, usually it's either a protein bar or two. And then I also do granola with milk. So it's all dehydrated stuff. So either one of those two are my most recent options. Lunch are things like tortillas with peanut butter and honey is my personal favorite, or peanut butter just straight in general, or tortillas with pepperoni and cheese, something I can eat on the go. A lot of trail mix, a lot of jerky. I always have like a candy bar or two as snacks for that push when I need it up a mountain or a certain climb. And then for dinner, probably my favorite Mountain House meal right now is probably biscuits and gravy or beef stroganoff. So that's usually my go-to food packing list, I guess.
Oh, okay. For me, I don't eat too many big meals. It's, you know, a lot of snacking during the day, but my dinner, I usually go with the dehydrated, or my first night, I usually like to bring a steak, you know, frozen steak, take out of the freezer and then have it the first night, and then go from there.
Now, if I'm camping, that's a little different, because what I enjoy doing is to me, there's nothing better than a fresh burger over a campfire.
Yes.
And put like a slice of my friend Super Josh puts Munster cheese on it. And, you know, we toast the buns and we have a burger when we're camping. And then waking up for breakfast, something like bacon is always a classic. And then since you're camping and you don't have to be super healthy,
nope.
Put an egg in the bacon grease and cook it in that.
My grandmother used to use the bacon grease religiously. Actually, my parents too. For instead of butter or anything in the cast iron.
Oh,
for
oh yeah, yeah.
Always
yeah.
use the bacon grease for cooking.
That's why you're such a happy person, I think.
Yeah.
So what else do you have in your backpack? I'm sure our listeners would love to hear your current hammock setup and what you're currently hanging on.
Yeah, so my current hammock is a Dream Hammock Darien in the 1.6 Hyper D fabric. And so that's what I've used probably for the last couple of years. I'd say, you know, I transitioned away from the XLC that I started with, and I moved pretty quickly to the Dream Hammock, primarily because of weight. I could get a lot lighter with the Darien than I could the XLC. And then for a tarp, I use the Warbonnet Mini Fly in 3-season, and I try to stretch it into winter, but I right now have the Thunder Fly for more winter options, because the Mini Fly is great. Don't get me wrong, I can use it pretty much year round. But where the extra length on the body of the tarp really helps cut down wind when it starts cooling off a little bit more.
Okay.
And so that extra bit really helps me. And then for, of course, my sleeping pad, I use the Thermarest X-Therm pretty much year round. In the summer, what I'll end up doing is I'll just kind of deflate it a little more because I don't have to care about getting super warm. And actually sometimes in the summer, if I have the X-Therm in there, I pretty much am sleeping in shorts and a t-shirt anyway, and I kick off the quilt. And the quilt option, it just varies depending on the temps. In the summertime, I try to use the Mass Drop Pine Down Blanket, which is probably a really strong value option. I love that thing. And then in the colder months, I use the Enlighten Equipment Enigma.
Okay, cool.
And so my hammock, I use whoopee slings and tree straps. And in terms of, I don't use a ridgeline for my tarp because the Warbonnet tarps actually don't really need one, and I haven't found it necessary for me. I use the Dutchware Stingers with that Zingit line, and that's so easy and fast. I don't use anything else.
Okay. Yeah, like a lot of the bling makes things a little simpler.
Yeah, and I've tried some other things as well. I know my friends have used the Loop Aliens and some of the other. I saw Warbonnet came out with a new hardware that looks fairly similar. I haven't tried that yet, but the stinger is so easy. You know, just having that loop and around the antenna mm-hmm. of the stinger, and it makes it simple.
Yeah, nice and solid. Yeah. Anything else that you bring camping that you never leave the house without when you're going camping? even for car camping stuff, right? Like just the stuff that you rely on and is always in your kit.
Always in my kit. I always bring a Puffy for a long time. I use the Mountain Hardware Ghost Whisperer.
Oh yeah.
Is what I use a lot for you know, since I started. Right now I'm transitioning. There was nothing wrong with the Ghost Whisperer, just it's one of those things that are being on YouTube and creating content. I do want to try new things. And so I'm trying right now the Enlighten Equipment Torrid jacket out. And I've been really impressed with that so far.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I just literally this past week got the Loftech from, what was their names?
Outdoor Vitals.
They had a Kickstarter for a Puffy that uses like some artificial, you know, it's not down, it's something like down or whatever. It's a shame it came just as the summer was coming on. But, you know, for us up here in the shoulder seasons, having a lot more moisture or the potential for moisture, I was starting to get anxious sometimes, you know, going hiking in the spring with a down jacket. And I just didn't want to do it anymore. But I love having a puffy.
Yeah, it's nice.
Anything that, you know, I'm always curious, you know, nobody ever talks about the gear that they got that they wish really worked. Like they got it and they're like, this is the most awesome stuff or whatever. And then it just sucked for one reason or another, you know, either didn't work the right way or you ended up staying in your pack for the whole trip. I mean, do you have any experience with that kind of thing where it's just like, yeah, I don't think I'm going to bring that again.
Yeah, I think it was, I mentioned it on my channel a little while ago, but the Nock Vecto water bag has not worked well for me. And so I know some people really love that. I guess some people pronounce it C-Nock, but I'm pretty sure it's Nock. Some people really love it, but for me, it has always leaked. I've tried all their different troubleshooting, and for me, it just didn't work. It didn't even make it past my home test.
Oh,
wow. I tested it at home and tried to just let it sit overnight and see if it would leak. It leaked every time. And so I actually used an Evernew water bag because of that. But I really wanted that to work because it seemed like it, like a lot of people do like it, but it just did not work well for me. Another thing that I think an issue that it had was the open top clasp at the top where you're supposed to scoop the water with. Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty springy, so it's hard to do it with one hand. Which is, yeah, to me, I mean, it's the whole point of having the scoop is that it just makes it a little bit more difficult. But that was one that comes to mind right away that didn't work. One I'm testing right now that actually I've had the opposite experience. A lot of people are having issues with is the Sawyer micro squeeze.
Oh, yeah. I just got that too.
Yeah. And so some people, yeah, I've really had good experiences with mine. I haven't had issues with it clogging up or anything, but I know quite a few people who've had issues with it slowing down and it not being great, especially when it just came out of the box, which is, I mean, understandable, but I haven't had the negative experience with that some people have.
Yeah. Anything you keep on putting in your bag thinking that it's going to be better this time?
No, usually I'm pretty fickle. If something fails me once, I usually don't want to bring it again.
You did a video last year, I believe, titled "Brown People Don't Camp, It's a White People Hobby." Now, this is a comment on Facebook that over at HYOH, we got a while back as well, all the way back in 2016, right before a women's episode. I don't see it as a barrier. It's a white male cultural thing. This feels like a problem that isn't really a problem. Now, what do you think we could do to make the outdoors more available to more folks of different races or cultures?
I think that's an interesting question because I've talked about it a bunch, of course, after that video with people. And I think the biggest thing is probably exposure. And so, for example, in my case, I talked about it in that video. One of the reasons I do this and document it on film is for my own kids to see, because I didn't see my dad do any of this stuff. And the big reason I think it ends up being a problem is that, the outdoors, I think how should I say this? I would like it if the outdoors reflected society in general. And so to me, I think it's a problem if it doesn't, because I think people are either afraid to go out because they don't know anyone else who can go out there and do those kind of things. And that's one of the reasons why, like I said, I started the channel is for people to see that, hey, you know, other people do this too. It's not just for this one group. And that's what the experience that I had was when I showed my cousins Hocking Hills for the first time. And they were blown away because I love looking at their faces because they had the same reaction I did when they realized, because they're from the city, they're definitely more urban culture, and they had the same experience where they thought to themselves, no one told me that this stuff was out here. And the nice part was that I was able to make it more accessible for them because they said, Tim, I want to go hike with you. I've seen some of the stuff you do. I want to see that stuff too. And so a lot of it, I think, comes down to people not being available that they see like them out there. And so I think that it's not something I try to I mentioned occasion in the channel, like I did in that video. But I tried to make sure that people understand that, I'm doing this to make sure that people see people like me out there.
Yeah. Cause really, if you think about it, I mean, there's not much of a, race issue in the sense that if you go out in the woods, you need your shelter, your food, your water. It doesn't matter what color the skin you have. It's more just, getting the word out and, somebody that's from the city or something saying, there's more than these cement sidewalks and brick buildings to the world.
I think a lot of it is it's cultural and generational, because even I remember my parents, my mom still says, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this?" And I mean, she has no connection to that. And part of this, the idea of a little bit of fear, a little bit of, this is not something that culturally we have done, and it's not something that is part of their understanding of connecting to the outdoors in that way. And like, it goes back to experiences. And sometimes the outdoor experience of, like you mentioned, people of color in the outdoors has not always been positive. And so I think that sometimes turns some people off. But as well as, I think a key component is that they're afraid to go by themselves. And so if they can just know someone who goes out and who is willing to go with them, I think that breaks down a lot of barriers.
Good.
That's cool. Yeah. The other side of it is, like for women, I've heard this comment before, is like being uncomfortable just from the mansplaining or whatever. Is there a way that we can not, is there a way that people who are more comfortable can avoid making other people uncomfortable with the experience, right? Like, what's the thing to be aware of to not do when you meet somebody at a shelter for the first time and you're like, wow, they don't look like me. They're darker, or they're, I'm not used to having women at a shelter. What do I do?
Yeah. I think it's important to be genuine. And I think it's important to be yourself and be comfortable in your own skin. And as long as you have the intent to be helpful or ask if someone needs help, I think that's all that stuff is okay to do. I think genuine conversation, I think is important. And I think it's really important to just, treat people like people, and hopefully they realize that your intent is positive and it's not a negative one.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. You're welcome.
One of the things I consistently like to ask people at the end of our conversations is, I guess, a little bit more philosophical, but it doesn't need to be. If there was one thing that you could teach the world, what would it be?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I can think of right away is that ranch is not made for chicken wings. It's for blue cheese. And I hope I can settle that once and for all, is that blue cheese is hands down the winner. It's far superior than ranch in any application.
Thank you.
No, but on a serious note, I think the biggest thing I always go back to when I try to think about in the channel is be kind to people. I think it doesn't cost anything to be kind. I think it's been said a lot. I feel like I hear that a lot. But I think it's important to be genuine and be kind. It doesn't cost you anything. And I think we'd be a lot better off if everyone followed or ascribed to that philosophy.
Cool.
Good. Now we come to our roundtable discussion, where I throw something out and we each give our ideas on it. And to this time we have, going back to the beginning of the interview, toilet and hygiene kits. It all comes down to pooping in the woods. Tim, we'll start off with you. What's in your kit?
All right. So I use the Chi Wiz Big Dig as my trowel of choice. And that's usually the one I grab every time. But then in my toileting kit, I have wet wipes, toilet paper, hand sanitizer, and that's it.
Yeah, short and simple. Jonathan, how about you?
I'm lined up pretty close to that. I actually got the Deuce Scoop, which It's nice and lightweight, and it cuts really well through like roots and stuff. I've always been frustrated with that. I know a lot of people are like, oh, you could just dig a hole with a hiking pole, but that's a graphite stick. You don't want to wreck that trying to dig a hole in the ground, you know?
Yeah.
And those people, I believe, are liars. Have you ever tried to dig
with a once. Stick?
Yeah, same here. I tried that once, and yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, if you're in the desert, I suppose, but otherwise, yeah. You need cutting tools, man. If I could bring a chainsaw. So I've got the Deuce Scoop. It is lightweight, and you can kind of sharpen the front edge a little bit if you need to. Toilet paper. Definitely the hand sanitizer. I have been shocked when people have come back with their toilet paper and not had hand sanitizer and... kind of had this weird look when I'm like, here's my hand sanitizer. Why don't you use this? Why don't you use all of it right now?
When's dinner?
And you're eating by yourself. You know, and but I also keep a little eyedropper bottle of actual soap, the you know, the peppermint soap. What is it?
Dr. Bronze.
Dr. Bronze. And usually when I get into camp and then before I eat, if we're near water, I actually like to actually wash my hands instead of just use the, partly just to get the grime off my hands when I know I'm going to be eating. But nothing really replaces, you know, actually washing your hands and having that physical action, you know, along with the sanitizing agent.
And that's really smart because do you know that norovirus is not killed by hand sanitizer. It's only gotten rid of by hand washing.
Ah, this is why we can't have good things. It just keeps getting worse. Yeah, I was just reading an article about all the bad things that ticks carry, and yep. Camping is dangerous, man, but wash your hands. It's a good way to start, right?
Yep. Yes. So yeah, but the ticks, I mean, you don't have to be camping to get the ticks. That can be anywhere. So might as well go out in the woods and enjoy it.
What about you, Mark? What do you keep in your kit?
I just got a cheap knockoff scoop that I just got from Wally World or somewhere, I don't remember. And then, yeah, with the same thing with digging holes and all. And then, you know, usually a partial roll of toilet paper so I can squeeze it down into the Ziploc bag that I keep it in. Some same thing as you guys, the hand sanitizer, which, you know, it's always the dual purpose because you can use it as a fire starter as well.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes I'll just throw in there if I use it, just not the soap like you have, but I just have like a bar of the, you know, something from the hotel or something.
Okay.
Just if I can use it and, you know, grab a thing of water and bring it all away from the water source and at least, you know, wash my hands that way if I had to do something. So
yeah. So
yeah, but
you know. We got three people, no bidets.
No.
You wouldn't have to use hand sanitizer that way.
That's true. But I wouldn't want to do it in the winter.
No.
Yeah. Icicles hurt up there.
That's true. Well, Tim, this was a really awesome conversation. We love talking to people who are hiking and enjoying the outdoors as much as we do. And we're really grateful that you were willing to give us some of your time to spend just chit-chatting and talking about stuff that we love.
You're very welcome. I appreciate you having me on, guys.
So, Mark, I know we both like to use our GPS on our phones for navigation. I actually like bringing my Apple Watch as well because I actually like kind of tracking where we're going and stuff through that device. But there's this question that we always have to ask, which is how are we going to recharge at the end of the day? Our smartphones and such usually don't get through more than a day or so of a charge. So I thought it might be interesting to kind of chit-chat about what you're doing to kind of keep powered up through your weekend or through your backpacking or hiking or camping trip.
Well, starting off with me, I about a year or so ago, actually, I got an Anker charger, and I got one of the bigger ones. So it's like I think it's the 20,100 Anchor.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I use it outside of camping as well when I'm in if I'm in a pinch, and because I keep it in my computer bag, so it's always with me, and it works great. It's a quick charge, but it's like seven. I mean, I think I could charge my phone like seven times with it, but it's like I think it's like a pound, which is a little heavy for what I'm doing, because I'm pretty much just a weekend warrior.
Yeah.
And unless you're out there for a week or so at a time, I think it's almost overkill. So I am thinking about getting something smaller. I'm really happy with the Anchor brand, but just something, just, you know, I could probably get something that's half the weight and would still, I'd end up getting into the car that, you know, whenever I'm leaving with a charge left on the actual charger.
We should trade. I've got something much smaller and I'm always running out, but I've really liked that I've gotten into, or we've gotten into a time where you don't have to have a lot of throwaway batteries.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have to carry a bunch of AAAs or AAs or both with me, because, you know, I got a, you know, my headlamp recharges over USB, and the phone, and, you know, the watch if I bring it, of course, but also other things that I bring, you know, like I have the two-way GPS that I bought and that I use. That's also something that, you know, if I use it a lot, needs a recharge, especially if you're, there's a lot of tree cover where it's constantly trying to find satellites. And so I also have, I think I've got a 10,000 battery right now, which is good for like one or two recharges of kind of everything.
Right.
But I've played with some other stuff. I've played with solar and been super disappointed with that for a couple of reasons. One is being under trees when we're backpacking means you're not getting that much light. I think that's
right.
A huge problem.
Yeah. And that same thing, like I used to keep for a lantern at night, one of those Lucy lamps. Mm-hmm. And I've ditched it. The solar just, I always remember Friday night to check, you know, if we're leaving Saturday morning early, I always remember Friday night that I have to check it to make sure it's got battery. And half the time it doesn't, probably more than half the time it doesn't. So I try and clip it onto the outside of my pack, and it never, you know, never gets enough charge during the day. And that's why, you know, I'm going to go with something else with that. And I am thinking about getting, I got to get a new headlamp. So I want to go with the charging one, like you said, you have, just because, you know, it just makes it easier. The solar, it's, I don't know. And it's a slow charge too, isn't it?
It really can be. Yeah. The amount of wattage that you get out of, well, it depends how big your panel is, right? And I think that's the ultimate problem is there's a weight to energy trade-off with the solar panels. They're not really that efficient compared to other options for the amount of weight that you have to carry, right? Like if you wanted to get enough power to recharge your phone in a small amount of time, like when you're hanging out, you know, with where you can get sun on your solar panel, you're going to have, you know, 2 or 3 pounds worth of panels.
You're going to have to take one off your roof and carry it with you.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I've actually played with like little solar panels for, like, to just throw in the car to see if I could get it working. And that's almost always the same experience, is it just doesn't put out the wattage that you need to get enough energy. Our phones consume a ton of energy.
Yeah. That's why I usually try and keep mine in airplane mode, because 9 times out of 10, you know, we're in an area that doesn't get signal anyway. So why bother wasting the battery? And I'm out in the woods and I'd rather not hear from the real world at the time.
Yeah, that was a really good thing when now you're on Android, I'm on iPhone. The iPhone chipset, the GPS part of it didn't used to work unless right. You had your cell service on, and they fixed that recently, like iPhone 7, iPhone 8-ish. Mm-hmm. So I can now put my phone completely into airplane mode and still be able to use the GPS part of it, which saves a bunch of energy. That's actually been a really good experience.
Yeah, that's nice to, with the Androids that I've had, that I haven't had that problem. And you don't even have to think about it. All you do is, you know, just pop it into airplane mode and the GPS is still on as long as your location services is on, and which mine is always on. So that does, it definitely makes it easy that way.
You're still using Gaia?
Yeah, yeah, I love it. I love it. And it, you know, it hasn't let me down yet, and it's easy to pop my maps in. You know, usually we're on the Finger Lakes Trail, so I have the maps they gave, the, was it the GSX file, is it?
Yeah.
Yep. Where, you know, I can make sure I'm on the right trail and everything and see where all the water sources are. It's, you know, it's like a, it's almost like a really, really scaled down version of, what's the one they use on the AT, or the, even the piece, gut hooks, is it? Or,
yeah, gut hooks.
Yeah, it's something like that. It's just not updated by other people. So, but it works out great.
Yeah, I know this is a bit of a side comment, but I do, I should do a little plug for, there's an app that I've been using that's only on the computer right now called Art of the Track. And I've been playing around with a lot for trip planning. Okay. And they're still fairly, I'm not going to say they're beta, but they're not 100% yet. They're still improving their product. But for any of our listeners who are looking for like a trip planning system, it's got a lot of the things that you'd want for trip planning. You know, it can measure distances. They've got most of the trails out there in their system. It can actually invite other people, and you can build checklists and communicate and stuff like that. It's a neat little system. So I know that's a little bit of a sidebar, but check out Art of the Track if you're looking for a trip planning system for tracking your trips. That being said, I also tried the BioLite. Remember that?
Yes, I do. You got it like right when they came out or something, I thought.
Oh, I thought that was going to be the solution to all of my power problems, Mark.
Yeah, but it's was that same thing. It was a slow charge. It was heavy and it was big.
Yeah, it turns out that energy is a complicated problem.
Yeah, it is.
So I did bring it with me on a couple of trips, and it worked out really well, but it was a lot more weight than I wanted to carry, and you kind of have to like sit and feed the fire for like an hour or two to get a full recharge on your phone. I mean, it took a lot of energy using the thermoelectric mechanism in the device to get enough energy out of it. You know, you're essentially babysitting a tiny campfire for an hour or two, and I couldn't stand doing that.
Yeah, it's tough doing all that. That's why I like the try and think about how I'm using my phone, because I do use it. I love taking pictures, mm-hmm. and so that's really the only thing that I'm using my phone for. Besides that, it's in my pocket.
Just tracking steps.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you know, I don't have too much stuff that I'm using that I require a battery. That's why I think it's, you know, definitely in the future to scale down my battery.
Well, you might want to hang on to, well, I know it's heavy, but you might want to hang down onto it if you're going to be adding more stuff in that's USB rechargeable.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's one of those things, I'll play it by ear, and you know, once I do get a new headlamp, and if there's anything else, you know, take it out on a couple trips and then, you know, leave with it fully charged and use everything how my normal use is, and then see what's left in it when I get home after the trip.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, one quick sidebar for our listeners. You mentioned a 20,000 milliamp hour battery, mm-hmm. and I mentioned a 10,000 milliamp hour battery. Some of our listeners may not know what that means, or may not have thought about it, but every phone has a battery in it as well, and they usually indicate how big that battery is with the same measurement. Like an iPhone is, I think, 1,700 milliamp hours, which means if you figure 2,000, because there's some energy loss, goes into a 10,000 about five times. So it's a nice kind of way to figure out how many full recharges you can get of that particular device within that particular window. So when you're kind of doing your trip planning, that's one of the ways you can deal with the calculation, is to say, okay, well, a 20,000 milliamp hour battery will give me X number of recharges when you divide it by the size of the battery in your phone or other device.
Yeah. So like I just happened to look up while we're while you were speaking. And so I've got a, right now I'm using a Samsung Galaxy S8
okay.
the Plus, and I looked up and that shows it's got a 3000 milliamp battery in it. So, you know, and then with a 20,000 milliamp charger, you know, I could, you know, probably about 5-6 times
yep.
go from 0 to 100%. So, and with an airplane mode, you know, a lot of times when I go to bed, I may still have 55-60%. So that, you know, that 5-6 charge, which going from 0 to 100 could last me 4 or 5 days. It would, in reality, it would work in airplane mode, could be, you know, 10-15 days.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely overkill.
Yeah. Where I'm not out that long. So,
yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Well, I'm sure our listeners will share with us some of their experiences with bringing technology, and we're going to have a couple that they're going to say, leave it at home.
Yep.
You've got a map and compass, use it. Yep. It. Which I can respect as well.
Only when the technology fails.
Exactly. Exactly. But if not, why not bring it?
Yep.
Welcome to the segment of the show that we like to call Hanging with Gresh and Spagaver. Today, it's just me, just Spagaver. Unfortunately, Gresh and I couldn't get our schedules to mesh, so this month I will be handling the questions by myself. But next month, we'll be back together to answer your questions. So make sure you guys have plenty of questions coming to us. All right, let's jump right straight into this. First question we've got is from Christy Rhodes on Facebook. One of your podcasts, you mentioned that when you have a lot of gear to treat, you mix up a bucket full and dunk your stuff in it. Did I understand that correctly? If so, would you let me know where to find this stuff? So far, we've only seen the pumps. Thanks, Christy. So what Christy's referring to is permethrin. And so I've actually done, I've covered this quite a bit on my YouTube channel on Spagaver Backpacking. I've done a couple of different videos where I talk about dealing with ticks and other insects and the problems that that they bring. So recently, I actually did one where I showed mixing up a concentrated version. You can go on to Amazon or any like equine store and find the concentrated. They're like 32 or 36%. You can get them in the 12% range as well. So the Sawyer stuff that you buy at the store is mixed up to a 0.05%, I believe is the correct amount mixture. So the active permethrin in there is at a 0.05% solution. And that's what's effective and good for dealing with ticks on your clothing. So you can buy it pre-mixed from Sawyer, just like Christy was talking about, where it's in the pumps. However, you can actually buy it in this concentrated form and then mix up bigger batches. And that's going to be a lot more cost effective. And that's what I show in my video. So the way that I do it, I don't actually do the dunk method. I mix it up a gallon at a time. So if you've got the 32 or 36, I can't recall exactly what it is that I have. But it's a highly concentrated solution. And it ends up being 2 ounces of the permethrin to a gallon of water. Mix it up. I put it into a pump Roundup spray bottle. That fits a full gallon. So I'll pour the whole thing in there. I'll lay out my clothes or hang up my clothes or my gear and spray it down that way. Now, I know a lot of people do the dunk method, and it definitely will get the permethrin more exposed to the complete amount of clothing. There's not going to be any missed areas. If you're spraying it the way that I do, you know, there's a chance that you could miss some areas. And really, I only treat the outside of my clothing. So if you were doing the dunk method, you're definitely getting the inside and the outside a little bit better. Like I said, it's available on Amazon, and it does make it a whole lot more cost effective to go that route. The Sawyer stuff can get expensive because you don't get a whole lot of it for the price. To take it a step further, one of the things that I do to make my tick prevention or even mosquito prevention a little bit better is I do the permethrin on the clothing, but then I also use Picardin on my skin. Now, I was using DEET for a long time, but DEET is some pretty nasty stuff, especially when you get into the higher concentrations. The problem with DEET is that it will melt plastics. And so most of our really high quality, lightweight camping or hiking or backpacking type stuff is made of nylons and other types of fabrics that have some sort of a plastic base to them. And what you end up having is melted gear, or the potential for it. You know, if you put it on and then you get into your hammock, there's a very strong possibility you could damage your hammock. So I have shifted away from that. And research has found that the Picardin is nearly as effective as DEET, if not as effective. So that's what I've kind of gone to. So Chrissy, I hope that answers your question on the permethrin deal. You can absolutely dunk your stuff, soak it. I know some people, Chris Gerken has a thing that he did. I think it's on gearreport.com, where he shows how he mixes it up. He has like gallon plastic bags that he likes to put his clothes in and soak them that way. So that's another route you can go. But you can absolutely go over, check out Spagyver Backpacking YouTube channel and see the video that I've done on there. Okay, the next question that we've got is from Mike Brown, and this was also via Facebook. This one is, at what expected overnight temperature do you leave the underquilt at home? All right, this is a great question and one that I wanted to talk about. Leaving your underquilt at home. Okay, so let's talk about the temperature ranges where you really don't need an underquilt. It's kind of that standard answer of it depends. So I think it depends a lot on where you are, whether or not you even want to consider leaving your quilt at home. What type of weather pattern are you in? How hot is it? I would say most people consider anything below 60 to 70 degrees mandatory underquilt or some sort of insulation, whether it be a pad or a reflective sheet, something underneath you, anywhere below 60 to 70. And that's going to vary depending on how you sleep. Other things you have to consider is how much wind is there. Because it is convective heat loss and not conductive heat loss, the amount of wind underneath you definitely plays a big factor, a big role in how cold you're going to get when the wind blows. You could be completely fine at 60 degrees in a calm environment, but same environment, you get into the same situation, you're out there, no underquilt, it's 68, 70 degrees, and there's a strong wind, and that can really, really sap you of your warmth. So it depends. Somewhere between 60 and 70, I think most people would agree, is where you can start getting away without an underquilt underneath you. Now, I have been out on some pretty good trips where I didn't think I was going to need my underquilt. I had my underquilt with me. And even my 50-degree underquilt, I take most of the year. And the reason is you never know when a crazy storm is going to pop up. And I don't know about you guys, but I have been out in some pretty nasty storms that when they pop up, the temperature drops 15, 20 degrees as these storms roll through. And when that happens in the middle of the night and you're laying in your hammock, even if you've got a great shelter set up over you, a tarp, or you're actually hanging under a pavilion or something where there's no chance of you getting wet, that drop in temperature, the increase in wind is going to make you extremely cold. Now, I've told the story several times, but it was one of the very first big trips that I did using a hammock. My friend Mike, who you guys know is Beekeeper, he and I were out. We were just starting out doing the southern part of the Appalachian Trail. So we've done sections of the trail throughout many years. But now that I had moved to South Carolina, we were getting started right at the Amicalola Falls State Park, doing the approach trail and heading up. So the very first night, we drove in, got there a little bit late. So we only hiked. There's a shelter like a mile before Springer Mountain, right before you actually start the AT. So we'd done the approach trail up to that point, got in after dark, set up, and I did not bring an underquilt with me on that trip because it was supposed to be in the 60s and 70s overnight, and I froze. The wind had picked up, and I was completely uncomfortable. I did not sleep well. Ended up finding stuff on the ground, using my backpack, using clothing underneath me. I was using a double layer hammock, and so I was stuffing stuff in between the two layers to try and stay warm. I personally do not suggest anyone go out on any trip without an underquilt. It's not that much extra weight. Even if it's a 2-pound underquilt, 2 pounds is not that big a deal when you're talking about whether or not you're going to sleep. I can tell you right now that if you're out for a 3-day trip and you have 2 bad nights of sleep, your pack's going to be heavier or feel heavier than it would if you carried an extra 2 pounds and you got great sleep. Don't sacrifice sleep for weight. That's kind of my take on it. Yeah, you probably will be safe most times if it's in the 60s, 70s, or anything warmer than that. If you know that you're in an area that isn't all that windy, it's in the 80s overnight, there's no chance of storms, maybe you can get away with it. But I don't know about you guys, but I'd rather be safe than sorry. It's one of those things where I don't deal well with sleep deprivation, so I don't want to put myself in that situation. All right. Well, I think I covered that one. If you guys have any other questions, please make sure you submit them so that we get the chance to answer them and talk about them on here. All right, guys. I hope you guys enjoyed this. Next time, Gresh will be back, and we'll be getting this thing knocked out. You guys know where to find us. I'm on YouTube. Gresh is on Facebook. I'm also on Facebook. You guys keep it going. I will see you guys down the trail. Hang your own hang, guys.
So, Mark, one of the things I like to do is kind of brag about who's coming up next. Keeps us honest. It hasn't bitten us in the butt too many times. but for next month, we're really excited to have AT Troll. You can find him as AT Troll on the forums. He's actually the guy who owns the Hammock Forums and operates it. And he also owns and operates White Blaze, which Hammock Forums came out of. And he's also just recently wrote a guide to the AT, which is pretty cool. He's walked the AT a couple of times himself. So I'm really looking forward to talking a little bit about what it takes to build a community from scratch and to manage that community so that it continues to be successful. And then maybe hear a little bit about how you write a book about something that you love.
Yeah, it should be a great interview. I look forward to talking to him about all the forums and hiking the AT and just hammocks in general.
Yeah, should be fun.
All right, Jonathan, a few comments this month that we've got together. And let's see, starting off, we have Natasha Tucker on Facebook regarding episode 39. Just popping in to say how much I appreciated this episode. As a ranger myself, county system in Indiana, nothing glamorous like a Utah ranger, I am always looking into how to get the public more involved in the outdoors. I've wanted to try to get a hammock stand somewhere in our system. I'll be digging more into this.
Yeah, that's very cool. Natasha, reach out to us if you want, and we can share contact information with our guests from that episode. Maybe we can get you guys together.
Yeah, that'd be great. And next, another Facebook post. We have Kevin Burke on episode 45, where we spoke to Frozen. I love this podcast and always look forward to the new episode every month, but I have one criticism in that I've noticed over the past few months it's become very hiking heavy. And in this month's offering, it was 20 minutes before the word hammock was even mentioned. I'm not a hiker, but I love hammocking. I feel people who car camp are looked down upon. Maybe I'm being overly critical, but that's how I feel. Well, no, I could see that, but my defense in that, because I know I set up the Frozen interview, hiking the AT, we're like right in the thick of things right now for the actual hikers, and it's sort of a dream of mine. So, and the guys we talked to, they're still hammock campers, but like Frozen, it just happened to be he's hiking the AT, Actually, let's see. Today's the 13th. I think he summited Mount Washington today. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't see any difference getting in the outdoors, whether you're car camping or backpacking. You know, camping's camping. You're still sleeping in a hammock, whether you drove up to your site and set up your hammock or you walked 10 miles and then set up your hammock.
Yeah.
So, and we do both.
Yeah. The reality, Kevin, is that Mark and I spend a lot more time car camping than we do hiking or backpacking.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, with Boy Scouts and all, we're not really, our troop isn't a big backpacking troop. So yeah, most of my nights out is probably walking 100 yards to the campsite because just to get away from the boys.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kevin, thank you for the comment though. And we'll definitely be more thoughtful about that and keep that content evergreen for those of our listeners who are avid hammock campers.
And lastly, this one's for Jonathan. Woo-hoo. We got a message on the HYOH podcast website from Jim Davis. He said, I want to say that on a recent scout outing, I was having a hard time getting my feet warm, even after changing socks. I remembered Jonathan's advice and took them off. My feet warmed right up.
Ha! That is so cool.
And he didn't have to bribe him for the for the comment either.
That's right. You know what? For me, at least, I know that a big part of staying warm is having good circulation, and that's why it works well for me. So I'm glad that somebody else benefited from that experience. And Mark, I know you love your fluffy socks, and everybody's got to figure out what works for them.
Yeah, exactly. And same thing with all your equipment. It comes down to, you know, what makes you comfortable.
Yep, absolutely. So thanks, Jim.
So we'd like to thank all our donors that have donated to our cups of coffee and Timbits for us. We really appreciate it. That, you know, that really makes it a lot easier to help produce this every month.
Yes, every little bit counts, especially those of you guys who are following us on Patreon. And for those of you, like Mark said, who just buy us a cup of coffee or some Timbits, we really appreciate it.
And that's the show for this month. As always, you can find us at www.hyohpodcast.com or on our Facebook page at HYOH Podcast. If you like what you hear, please give us a positive review on iTunes, or even better, you can buy us a cup of coffee by going directly to hyohpodcast.com/donate and making a one-time donation.
Right, and don't forget to tell your friends about us, and be sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Google Play or whatever podcast player you like to listen to. You can also just share with your friends the website, and they can listen to the podcast on the website if your friend has not yet bought themselves a smartphone.
As always, if you want to comment or have a question, please visit our Facebook page, or you can send me an email at mark@hyohpodcast.com.
And me at jonathan@hyohpodcast.com. Finally, special thanks to Skid Von Ark for allowing us to use his music for both of our intro and our outro, and to ITX for hosting our podcast. Thanks, everyone, for hanging around. Yeah, the tent in my pack sorely weighed some pounds. I opened my eyes, and what did I see? A man from Minnesota swinging tree to tree. A thin piece of fabric suspended in the air. Should I even try it? Man, should you even dare? Had two straps and a couple of toggles. How this would even work, my mind began to boggle. Yeah.